This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The debate over guns in America often leads back to discussions of early American history and the importance of the gun in frontier culture. But some of the popular beliefs about early gun culture have more to do with myth than history, according to historian Michael Belial. He's the author of the new book Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture. He's a professor at Emory University, where he founded the Center for the Study of Violence. He says that it's a myth that in colonial times most men protected their homes with guns. The guns of the period were muskets, and muskets weren't easy to use.
Basically, to start with, they were big, they were clumsy, they were expensive, they were difficult to maintain, they had to be cleaned regularly because they're made out of iron, otherwise they would rust. It took time to learn how to use one, required a great deal of effort to practice with it, and to maintain the musket was also expensive because powder and shot all had to be imported from Europe, as was the musket itself. No one in America made more than a couple muskets a year. And those few people who did make muskets used, again, European parts. They were actually assembling them.
And you say not only didn't most colonials have guns, there weren't enough guns for the militias.
Yeah, that was for me the most surprising aspect of my research looking back in the 17th and 18th century. The English government wanted to control the access of firearms in the British North American colonies because they, of course, were suspicious of the use of these weapons by common people. They had a problem, though, in their colonies in that they had to rely on those common people occasionally to fight their wars for them. So they would ship arms to the governments of the British North American colonies, and those governments would store the firearms in central repositories to be used only in emergency situations. But again, they were nowhere near sufficient to arm even half the militia in the most vital period of the Seven Years' War.
So tell me, does that shed a different light on the Second Amendment saying that, about the right to a well-armed militia?
Well, it can be read that way. As near as I can tell, the historical context of the Second Amendment had two components. One was the experience of the American Revolution. Those people who wrote and approved the Second Amendment understood, remembered in most cases, that the Americans had been grotesquely underarmed and very unprepared for a long war, which is what they had, of course. It lasted 8 years. And their experience had been that if it had not been for France and the Netherlands supplying 85% of their firearms, with most of the rest coming from the English government itself, there was no way they would have won their independence. So that was one very important context. That's why the Constitution of the United States before the Second Amendment gave Congress a mandate to arm, train, and regulate the militia. Now, the second context is that the Anti-Federalists, the opponents of the Constitution, feared that mandate within the Constitution could lead to Congress refusing to arm the militia. And they understood that if Congress didn't arm the militia was largely unarmed because people didn't own that many guns. So Madison, and he was very explicit about this when he introduced the Second Amendment to the House of Representatives, Madison stated that he was responding to those fears, which he thought were ungrounded, of the Anti-Federalists by guaranteeing that no action of Congress would interfere with the states arming of their own militia. So I believe that's the historical context of the Second Amendment.
And you think that this context has to do in part with the fact that there weren't enough arms to go around?
I think that's exactly right. And the actions of the federal government immediately after the Second Amendment was passed, I believe, uphold that view because the Congress immediately took two key steps in opposite directions. On one hand, they wanted to arm the militia, so they established national gun manufacturers at Springfield and Harpers Ferry. And the second thing they did is they passed legislation to control the flow of firearms, the sale and possession of firearms, to those they perceived as dangerous, in this context, Indians and slaves.
Now, I think when we're talking about a well-regulated militia, that the word militia in the 1700s and the meaning of the word now has maybe changed. What did militia mean at the time?
The meaning of a militia has changed dramatically. In the 18th century, militia was a very carefully regulated local organization based on the community, whether that was a town or a county, depending on which colony or state we're in. And the membership was specifically defined by each legislature, and it was usually very explicitly limited to white Protestant adult males between certain ages who had demonstrated loyalty to the state. And at different times, loyalty oaths were required for service in the militia. All of this changed dramatically in 1909. The militia had largely died out as an institution in the United States as early as the 1820s. And in the early 20th century, there was an effort to revive the militia on a large scale to prepare Americans for their new global responsibilities. Theodore Roosevelt was a major proponent of this change. And it led to what's called the Dick Act of 1909, which reconstituted the traditional militia as the National Guard. And to this day, of course, the militia of the United States is the National Guard. So it is now very much a national institution rather than a local institution.
So the idea of a well-regulated militia and people having arms for that would be the equivalent now of people having arms who are in the National Guard.
Yes, that's exactly correct. Another, of course, key misunderstanding of the militia, which we can see in some of the private militia companies organized in our own times, is that the militia must always be regulated by the state. That is an ancient understanding that goes back to the 14th century in England and has been maintained in the United States throughout its history.
My guest is Michael Belial. He's the author of the new book, Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture. He's a professor of history at Emory University in Atlanta. You write in your book that until the mid-1800s, the American public seemed kind of uninterested in guns. What did you go through to come to that conclusion? What kind of like records and books and other things?
I went through every kind of record I could lay my hands on that had anything to do with firearms or public perceptions of firearms. I looked in legal records, probate records, court records as in civil cases, criminal prosecutions, newspapers, magazines, business records, personal account books, letters, diaries, travel accounts. Supposedly everyone owned firearms, according to the standard histories in my field, and everyone cared deeply about those guns, that they was part of their identification. But in fact, there were no pamphlets or books published on firearms prior to the American Revolution, and until the 1830s, there were only a handful of such pamphlets and guns published. And in addition, the newspapers were surprisingly quiet on firearms until the 1830s.
To me, growing up with Westerns on movies and TV, I always assumed that everyone in the West had a gun and that the gun really helped settle the West. Is that truth or fiction?
I grew up with exactly the same image and from exactly the same source, Western movies. And I think that's, in fact, has been the most influential historical record. Historians who have looked back into the later 19th century, looking at the period we call the Wild West, have found that the majority of settlers did not own firearms, largely because they were not necessary. Most of the settlers in the West were farmers or workers, something we tend to forget. The vast majority of men living in the West were, in fact, workers working in mines and as hired labor on farms, and they had no need for guns.
So from what I get out of your book, the real turning point in the history of the gun in America is in the 1840s when Colt starts to manufacture a pistol.
I think that's exactly correct. Samuel Colt was a genius, not only of technological development, but also of marketing. Samuel Colt appreciated that the gun did carry a certain mystique among the upper class, that it was associated closely with the elite way of life. This is, again, a tradition that goes back to medieval England, that the firearm was something that was owned only by members of the elite. Now, this was no longer the case in America, but nonetheless, it was associated with the upper classes. And so he appealed to this taste in his firearms by making them objects of real aesthetic beauty. He developed a method by which he could engrave every gun he produced with scenes of nature, with scenes of well-to-do people hunting in forests, but perhaps most significantly with scenes of individual men defending their families against savages and against burglars and robbers. So adding to the firearm this perception that it was absolutely necessary for personal self-defense. And his advertisements that he put in newspapers and magazines throughout the United States emphasized again and again that the individual man must own a gun in order to protect his family.
Samuel Colt's patent for his pistol ran out in 1857, so then other gun manufacturers started making pistols too. So now you have a real proliferation of guns in America. And then just a few years later, you have the American Civil War, which you also consider a real turning point in gun culture in the U.S. You say the Civil War armed the American people. Explain what you mean.
Well, most American soldiers went into training in the Civil War on both sides, North and South, with very little familiarity with firearms. Those who were responsible for training the soldiers reported that the majority of their troops had never even held a gun of any kind prior to enlistment. Their first necessary step was therefore to train their soldiers in the use of firearms. This training had an enormous impact in the long term because, after all, more than 2.5 million Americans served during the Civil War. In addition, the gun manufacturers found the Civil War a major opportunity to increase levels of production. Samuel Colt had figured out in the 1850s how to produce tens of thousands of guns for the first time, but he didn't have the market to justify that level of production. So, for instance, in 1860, in the entire United States, 50,000 firearms were made, which was the highest level of gun production up until that point. But by 1864, American gun makers were able to produce 1 million firearms a year. So this level of production, I think, had enormous long-term consequence, as did the training of so many American men in the use of firearms. And I believe also that training men to kill one another and to see that as a justified and necessary action for the preservation of liberty in the United States had an enormous psychological impact on Americans. It meant that the gun was a perfectly legitimate means of conflict resolution.
My guest is historian Michael Belial. His new book is called Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is historian Michael Belial, author of the new book Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, after the Revolutionary War, the government collected all of the guns that were
That's
used
correct.
To arm the militias. What happened to the guns after the Civil War?
The exact opposite. After the American Revolution, the government thought it was wisest to control those firearms that had been given to the United States by the Netherlands and France, or taken from the British on the field of battle. And so they collected them all into armories around the United States. After the Civil War, the government reasoned the exact opposite, that most of these firearms were already outdated because of the development of rapid fire guns, and therefore it was perfectly appropriate and much simpler and cheaper to simply allow troops to take their guns home. And that's exactly what the United States Congress allowed.
And what impact do you think that action had on gun culture?
I think it armed the American public. Guns appeared for the first time in nearly every home, and they became a permanent part of those homes.
There was still a frontier culture after the Civil War. Was that culture a more gun-oriented culture after the war?
Absolutely. Prior to the Civil War, while guns were present in the West, there really were not that many firearms available. And one of the major limitations, of course, was the absence of gun dealers, except for in San Francisco and Los Angeles. After the Civil War, not only was there a steady flow of firearms west as the settlers brought their guns with them from service in the Civil War, but also gun dealers opened shops throughout the Western territories, even in the smallest communities. The smallest towns would find themselves with gun dealers selling very cheap firearms. And that, of course, is one of the remarkable shifts in the gun culture of America. Prior to the Civil War, a gun was the equivalent to a month's wages. It had been the equivalent of half a year's wages for a skilled artisan back in the 18th century. After the Civil War, guns were available for as cheap as $5, which was equal to one day's wages for an unskilled worker.
So when you went back and looked at newspaper, magazine articles and probate records and court records after the Civil War, did you see a lot more guns?
Oh, yes. They appeared almost everywhere. Almost everywhere I looked, there were firearms, whereas before there had not been. The probate records, they just skyrocketed. Prior to the Civil War, they appeared in between, depending on the exact region we're talking about, between 10 and 20% of the probate records. After the Civil War, they appeared in the probate record of almost every adult male in the United States in every one of my sample sets. So guns, I think, had become rather omnipresent. But also another reflection of this this presence of firearms in American culture is that it was very difficult after the Civil War to read a story, to read even a romance set in the West of the United States without the presence of firearms and of gun violence, something that would have been very unusual prior to the Civil War.
So it sounds like that was reflecting kind of accurately what was happening, that there were a lot more guns, it was a much more violent culture, and the pop culture became more violent too.
I believe that's true, and it's interesting that foreign visitors noticed exactly the same transition. If you read travel accounts written prior to the Civil War, every foreign visitor is looking for what it is about America that's unique. What is it that makes the American democracy different? And they would talk about many factors, mobility and greed being the two most commonly mentioned in travel accounts of the early 19th century. After the Civil War, there is hardly a single travel account that does not mention somewhere how there seems to be guns everywhere, and it becomes associated with a unique American identity, one which is often loathed, but often admired, because these are real men. These are men who know how to take care of themselves and know how to defend themselves and their families, and who are rough and rugged. That, of course, is the standard that Theodore Roosevelt would appeal to in his very popular books at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th on the winning of the West and the strenuous life.
Now, your history of American gun culture ends more or less after the Civil War. Why did you end it there? Why not keep going? Too much work,
because it's already such a big book, exactly. And my daughter was getting awfully sick of these stories about firearms. But the larger answer to the question is, I wanted to tell a story about how it was that the most industrialized nation in the world, a nation which had attained a highly civilized democratic culture, one which allowed so much room for dissent and so much room for individual liberty, had developed also one of the most violent cultures in the world, certainly the most violent among the industrialized nations. And for me, that story ends, the story of its origins, if I may say this, ends in the 1870s. That's when that culture is in place, and it's the culture we live with to this day.
How do you think your research is going to be used? You know, gun ownership and gun regulation is one of the most controversial subjects in America. So how do you think your research will be used? How is it being used already? Who's arguing with you?
Well, this is the biggest shock I've had of all. When I wrote this book, I thought that my fellow historians would be interested and my fellow gun aficionados, people who are too easily called gun nuts in the public press, I thought they'd be fascinated by this story. But instead what has happened is I find that those people whom I thought would share my interests in terms of an interest in firearms don't like this book at all. And in fact, I've received a great deal of mail, both regular mail and email, condemning me as anti-gun. And when I've given talks over the last 5 years on the origins of American gun culture, there's always someone who stands up and says, you know, why are you so anti-gun? And I think this is very peculiar, because if I was talking about automobiles, and if I were to say that in the early years of the 20th century, there were very few cars in America, no one would get up and call me anti-car. But what is happening is I'm being labeled anti-gun every place I look. And this is, again, a very peculiar categorization of me. As a matter of fact, I've received mail from members of the National Rifle Association, including from their organizational headquarters, attacking me for being so anti-gun. Apparently, by questioning the solidity of this image of the past, of Americans as having always been gun nuts, I'm calling into question the current culture of gun ownership. This was never my intention. My intention was to find exactly when the gun culture started.
Do you think that the gun lobby in America has been drawing upon false history to justify its desire to prevent any further regulation of guns?
If I may restate that, I think they have been drawing upon a mythologized past to justify their position in terms of opposing any gun regulation today. I think that is correct. Now, I'm not going to criticize them for that. I would never do that, because historians have been repeating the same stories for the last 40 or 50 years. It is intriguing that if you go back into the 19th century, you find historians who aren't saying that all Americans own guns, because they knew better. But somehow we have come in the later 20th century, now, of course, entering the 21st, to believe that we have always been like this, that history somehow is immutable, but history is not immutable. So if what is happening, I believe, is that the gun lobby, based only on in their initial response to my book, and even before it's been published, in fact, drawing conclusions on the research before they've read it, I think they are trying to prevent a fair and open discussion of the reality of America's gun ownership.
Michael Belial is the author of the new book, Arming America, The Origins of a National Gun Culture. He's a professor of history at Emory University. Coming up, music critic Marlo Miles on Napster. This is Fresh Air.